given in Liber Samech. It's very different from the original Borderless Rite or the Headless Rite that's found in the Greek magical papyri. Kind of mixes up the Borderless Rite and the Watchtower and throws some god forms in and some other things. But it's a ritual I've been using for about a decade and a half, and I find it very comfortable. Very, very nice, potent little ritual. So should I get started? Okay, I'll start. So I want to start with some very simple preliminary definitions. I don't want to define these things in any detail at all at this point, because I want the complexities of what the Holy Guardian Angel is and what knowledge and conversation is to unfold over the course of the lecture. The nature of these things, I think, requires that they really shouldn't be simplified. So starting out, the Holy Guardian Angel is a divine or angelic being that serves as a sort of spiritual advisor. This is almost a gross oversimplification, but it's a okay place to start. Knowledge and conversation of the Holy Guardian Angel is a term used to signify the attainment of communion of some sort with that angel. The term Holy Guardian Angel has its origin in a 14th or 15th century book, a German book entitled The Book of Abramelin. Was originally translated by Mathers as The Sacred Magic of Abramelin the Mage, but it's really just the Book of Abramelin. It's German. It's Buch Abramelin. So there's a couple of wide, sweeping questions that I kind of want to pose with this lecture, and I don't want to really definitively answer them, because, again, the answers are far more complex than anything simple could possibly serve. So the first one is, what exactly is the Holy Guardian Angel? And as a corollary, is the angel something that could be said to be the self, or is it something outside of the self? Like I said, the answer to these questions are vast and complex and deep and subtle. One of the things I want to do with this lecture is to demonstrate why that is, and to give an idea of some of these complexities through the lenses of history, theory, and experience. My first conception of the Holy Guardian Angel came when I was tripping on acid when I was about 20. I never read a book on magic or anything. And it just kind of, over time and taking lots of acid, I don't recommend this necessarily as a way to get more information about these subjects. I was 20. It occurred to me, there are things about yourself that you couldn't know. There were things about this yourself that only you could see, but then there were other things about yourself that only other people could see, that your subjective experience of self would not allow you to see. But I thought, you know, it seemed to me that there must be some way in which you could get this kind of grand vision of the self that would allow you to know yourself kind of in totality, in a way that superseded the rational. And it would have to be some kind of, you know, mystical vision. I thought maybe if you took enough acid, you could do it or something. But so when I first started reading Crowley and I read about the Holy Guardian Angel, I immediately just glommed onto it and felt like, oh, I totally understand this. I know exactly what this is. I've been obsessed with this phenomenon for the last 6 months or so. And then, of course, my understanding of the complexities of what the Holy Guardian Angel is proceeded to get deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper over the course of the 2.5 centuries to follow, and they still continue to get deeper. So the second wide-ranging question is, are the various phenomena associated with the Holy Guardian Angel truly all manifestations of the same thing? So some of these things are the Agoides, Agatho demon, the perfect nature of the Platonists, the Sufi man of light, the Fravashi of the Zoroastrians. Am I pronouncing that right? You would know that with Zoroastrians, I thought. The true self, or the god image of Jung, the higher genius of the Golden Dawn. And there's a corollary to that question as well.
Can you just read that second question again for me, please?
Oh, the basic question is, are the various phenomena associated with the Holy Guardian Angel truly manifestations of the same thing? Or are these a bunch of disparate, separate things? So the corollary to that question is what Crowley referred to throughout his writings as knowledge and conversation of the Holy Guardian Angel the same thing that was indicated by the Book of Abramelin? There's some pretty compelling reasons to believe that Crowley took it to a completely different place. And yeah, I'll go into that in some fair detail a little later on. So let's see. We'll start out. I'll talk a little bit about the Book of Abramelin. I go back and forth in the way. You'll probably see me pronounce this like 5 different ways throughout the course of the lecture. I still really don't know how it's supposed to be pronounced. It was written by a Jewish man in Germany in the 14th, 15th century. No idea how he would have pronounced the book at that point. After that, I'll start going into the the history of things, the ideas of the personal demon of the Greeks, the tutelary spirit of the Greek magical papyri, the perfect nature of Hermes. I'll talk a little bit about the philosopher's angel of the Picatrix, the man of light of the Sufis, and the Fervashi of the Zoroastrians. I've also got some material on Jung, which at least one person in this room wants me to go over. Depends on how much time we have, I may not, or I may. And some material on W.B. Yeats. That's what would come at the very end. After I cover history, I'll go over Crowley's own experience with the Holy Guardian Angel and the way in which he kind of portrayed it in his writing. A lot of this is based partly in his journals and partly in his own edits of his journals after the fact. In other words, some of this information might be a little bit sketchy, but it's all we've got, so we do what we can. I also want to talk a little bit about my own ideas regarding the Holy Guardian Angel, based both in my own experience and the experience of others. And lastly, I'll give what seems to me to be a fairly balanced and reasonable practical approach, first to making contact with the angel, and then to deepening that contact into something that could be called knowledge and conversation. So we'll start with Abramelin, or Abramelin, or Abramelin. This is the book that the Holy Guardian Angel, the term was really coined with this book, as far as I know. I've never seen a reference to this that particular phrase before that. It's a 14th or 15th century book written by a German man, a German-Jewish man named Abraham of Worms. The book was brought first into the occult consciousness of the West in a fairly minor way when MacGregor Mathers, one of the founders of the Golden Dawn, translated an incomplete French version of the manuscript in 1898. The French translation itself was from 1750. Shortly after that, it was brought into the consciousness of occultism in the West in a far more major way when Aleister Crowley basically fixated on the book as the crown jewel in the entire corpus of Western magic, became completely obsessed with it, and it became kind of the central pivot of much of what for him kind of came afterwards. One of the central pivots. You could argue that it's the central pivot, but... at that point, you're getting into splitting hairs. Definitely has a big place in all of Crowley's holy books. So I don't really want to go too much into the differences between the French version that Mathers translated and the original German version, which was translated for the first time into English in 2006. That would take all night. It would be fascinating. I wish I could go into that, but we just don't have enough time. Suffice it to say, the two books are completely different. The French version, which is the only version that Crowley ever saw, detailed an operation that takes 6 months. The third part of the book, and in the French version there's three parts, and the German version there's four parts. The fourth part of the German book and the third part of the French book is filled with magic squares, so basically grids with spirit names in them. In the French translation, lots of the letters of these squares are missing. Lots of the squares themselves are missing. It's just completely a hack job, basically. So Mathers translated this because that was all he had. Or maybe he couldn't translate German. I don't really know. Probably the latter, actually. But that was originally translated, this incomplete French version. The German version, like I said, it was translated in 2006 by George Denn and Stephen Guth. We find out when that's translated that it's not a 6 month operation; it's an 18 month operation, and all of the letters that are missing from the squares weren't supposed to be missing. It was just whoever made the French version; it was a hack job. So, with the English translation of the German version, all of the squares are filled in. We have all of the letters, and the book is far more complete. A lot of what we know about Abramelin, a lot of kind of what's become kind of popular. I say popular culture knowledge, but what I really mean is a few hundred people know about it. What we know about it in our little tiny pocket of culture in the West, most of that comes from the French version. This has been the thing that people have been writing about and reading and talking about and basing their operations on for the whole last century. The English translation of the German version is comparatively new. The German version wasn't even in print until 1906. George Dan, the guy, one of the guys that did the translation, published it in 1996. Before that, it was available, I don't remember exactly where, in manuscript form somewhere, but you couldn't just, you know, go buy it somewhere and read it in German. So the book I'm going to cover is the English translation of the German version, the complete one. And that's probably the best place to start from. It's a four-part book. The first part, the whole thing is written as a narrative from Abraham to his son Lamech. The first part, Abraham recounts his worldly travels to his son. It's got a lot of like, now let me tell you, my son, about the next part of my magical adventures. He talks about his worldly travels. He was traveling the world in search of the sacred magic and the true wisdom. And in these travels, he meets many magicians, but none of them can teach him the true wisdom and the true magnum opus. And finally, in Egypt, Abraham of Worms meets Abramelin, who gives him two manuscripts in which are written plainly the keys to all of magic. Abraham goes on to describe where he performed the magic and how he used the many powers gained from his control of the spirits detailed therein. One of the interesting things about this book is it's often thought of as a book that's all about the Holy Guardian Angel. And it's like, this is about how you attained a knowledge and conversation with the Holy Guardian Angel, and that's what it's really about. And then there's this magical section at the end. Really, the whole book reads like a manual on magic. It's more like a reward than it is about this, you know, this kind of holy treatise on attaining to communion with the angel. It's the angel is part of that invoking the angel and getting a connection to the angel that allows you to do the magic, but it's really more of a big magical manual. Part two of the book contains a bunch of magical tidbits. So lots of them come from the books of Moses, various other works that were frequent at the time. It contains things like how to bewitch your neighbor's cows, how to burst open cliffs and walls if you happen to be imprisoned in them, how to escape if you're locked between iron walls by an enemy, how to cure diseases, how to put curses on people, how to make people fall in love with you. I'm sure your Holy Guardian Angel will totally want you to do all that stuff. Get in prison, because I gave you wonky advice. This is how you get out. Really important. This part is really just a primer on magical techniques. It ends in a big praise for the Kabbalistic arts and an admonition to put one's faith in God. Part three starts off with a little bit more about magic in general. It talks about things like planetary hours. It has a big section on the errors of past magicians and authorities and the errors of astrology. The reader is sternly warned that the Holy Guardian Angel would very much disapprove of any magician that does this work just to show off. After that, detailed instructions for carrying out the main operation of the book follow. The operation is to be begun in the first morning after the celebration of Easter, on the spring equinox, and it's to last 18 months. I'm going to reduce it to ultra basics. The book instructs that the practitioner isolate themselves in a house out in nature, gives very specific instructions of the layout of the house and how everything's supposed to be set up. The practitioner is instructed to free themselves from all business and social distractions. It's not a problem. For 18 months, we can all handle that, right? And then to begin daily adorations and prayers to the highest divinity. To pray once before sunrise and once after sunset. All time not spent in adoration is to be spent in quiet contemplation or reading holy text. Doesn't matter what holy text, any holy text. Doesn't matter what your prayer is or how you pray, just pray. That's another thing that's kind of an interesting thing about the operation itself. It's basically like, lock yourself up, do what you got to do for 18 months, and you'll totally get there. Make sure that what you read is holy, whatever you consider that to be. It's interestingly non-distinct. So after the first 6 months, the prayers and adorations are intensified. After another 6 months, they're increased to 3 times daily and intensified all the more. On the last day, all sorts of arrangements have to be made, after which the practitioner goes into their private temple and invokes the angel, who gives a sign by which the practitioner may invoke them again at any time. The next 3 days after that are to be spent in rapturous communion with the angel, during which time the angel will speak to you of the true wisdom and instruct you in where you've thus far failed in your work, what you lack, and how you should behave in order to control the unredeemed spirits. That's a big part of the operation. Getting control of the unredeemed spirits with the authority of your angel behind you. The angel also instructs you in how to achieve all that you desire. Again, this is all based, it's a very magic thing. You know, you get contact with your angel and you basically become a magical badass. You can do all this stuff. The rest of the third part of the book concerns the unredeemed spirits, which these are the so-called demons. There's 316 of them in all, arranged in a strict hierarchy starting with four infernal princes. The four infernal princes are Lucifer, Leviathan, Satan, and Belial. Those are followed by eight sub-princes, which are themselves followed by various servient spirits. Each of these spirits is to be sworn to obedience using a series of word squares, which are the grids that comprise the fourth part of the book, that contain various names. This can only be done, according to the book, by the authority of the Holy Guardian Angel. Admonitions are given to command these spirits in accordance with the instructions of your angel for the glory of Adonai and against the wiles of the devil. Which is interesting, because both Satan and Lucifer are two of the spirits that you have to swear to obedience. Book 4 is purely just the magical grids themselves. So some thoughts concerning the book. One of them is that it gives only the most basic description of the Holy Guardian Angel. The angel is described as a representative of God or Adonai. It's a basic description, but it is a definition. The way to invoke the angel is through prayer, isolation, and unrelenting prayer. Let's see, I already talked about how this was really more of a magic manual. Of course, it said, you know, all throughout the book that the purpose of this work is to learn how to do all this magic so that you can defeat the kingdom of evil for the glory of Adonai. This is so typical of the wars and magical manuals, period. Of course they say that. The other thing that I found really interesting, and I didn't notice this until fairly recently, but neither Mather's translation from the French or Dan and Gutt's translation from the older German anywhere in the text contain the phrase knowledge and conversation at all. The term conversation does come up in Mather's translation from the French. And if you look at where the English translation from the German, and you look at where the word conversation comes up in Mather's translation, most of the time in the German, the English translation of the German, it's translated as company rather than conversation. You get the company of the angel. Mm-hmm. Other times it's simply indicated that you're literally having a conversation with the angel. It's like you say something to the angel and the angel says something back. As far as I know, Crowley coined the term knowledge and conversation of the Holy Guardian Angel. And he coined it based on a passage from Mather's introduction to the book. Mather's introduction says, "From this it results that the magnum opus propounded in this work is, by purity and self-denial, to attain to the knowledge of and conversation with one's Holy Guardian Angel." Mm. Not knowledge and conversation of the Holy Guardian Angel, but knowledge of and conversation with. "So that thereby and thereafter, we may obtain the right of using the evil spirits for our servience in all material matters." Oh, is there a source of pure water? Mm-hmm. I'm totally going to run out eventually. My mouth gets so dry when I lecture.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. There's been a lot of speculation over the years that the terms knowledge and conversation were used at the time that Abramelin was first written as terms of intimacy, and that thereby knowledge and conversation kind of indicates an intimate degree of either sexual or symbolically sexual union with the angel. And I think there's a lot to that. I think this is something that's worth pursuing. But it's totally wrong in terms of fact, that knowledge and conversation was just not used. The other thing is, I mean, it's a German book, and even if knowledge and conversation in German do appear in the book, well, did they still have those conversations in medieval German? I have no idea. Or the German of the time? That always seemed kind of sketchy to me. But anyway, the German is available. You can actually order it from Amazon.de if you want the original German version. If you know German better than me and you're a linguist, I would be very curious to know if knowledge and conversation appears in that original German. Kind of don't think it does. One of the reasons why I think this is so important is Crowley used the term knowledge and conversation over and over and over and over again. It's become part of the parlance it's part of the terminology that we attribute to the angel. It's just everywhere. I think this is actually a very good thing, because I think that it can be used to indicate a degree of communion with the angel that's much deeper than just a vision. So though it's linguistically not quite right, I think we should keep using it. Let's see, I should mention that I'm in no way an Abramelin purist. I don't think that the only way to invoke the Holy Guardian Angel is to undergo the Abramelin operation. I don't think that Abramelin invented the Holy Guardian Angel. I think that there's a number of ways you can adapt the rite. And still have it work for you if the conditions are right. Let's see. All that said, I'm going to move on to kind of a historical overview. And we'll start with the Greeks. So the Greeks often referred to the genius or the demon of an individual as a guardian spirit that was assigned to the individual's soul. Hesiod mentions that the personal demon was from a race which existed in the Golden Age, which is the age of Kronos, and that the present function is to watch over and guide humankind. Socrates commonly referred to what he termed his daimonion, which was said to advise him in all philosophical matters, and especially in matters of restraint. Socrates' daimonion, like the one word he used more than anything else, was no. The demon specifically advised him never ever to defend himself, which is interesting considering how Socrates died. Socrates claimed that channeling his demon, he was able to serve a prophetic function, and that his demon was a possessor of much wisdom. That said, he seemed to regard his demon more, like not so much as an exterior being, but more as something akin to conscience. Something that's part of oneself that gets drawn out through spiritual work. He said it comes kind of as the voice of one's mature understanding of the world, gained through a life lived in recognition of the divine. Given that, Plato went on to assert that each human soul did indeed have a demon allotted to it, which acted as a person's guardian and guide throughout life, inasmuch as a person could become aware of it. He asserted that after death, the demon becomes visible as a living being. It's bound to the soul, but it's still seen as separate. In Plato's view, there was, you know, the realm of the eternal ideas, which is corresponded with the fixed stars, and then below that there was the realm of the planets, and then below that there was the realm of the gods and demons, and this is where the demon came from, the holy demon. Plato also said that when the soul reached the peak of its development, it would become pure mind, and that it would no longer have a need for a mortal body, and it would become a guardian demon itself and be given a body of fire. So that it may work in the service of the divine. Body of fire, that sounds so awesome. Actually, maybe we already have those. Anyway, it's an interesting idea. You could become a guardian demon yourself. There was also the concept that was current at the time of the kakodemon, or the evil demon, or the evil genius. This was reflected later as the idea of the dweller on the threshold. Agrippa later refers to the evil demon as the lowest of nine orders of spirits, which correspond to the nine orders of angels. And of this he says the following: moreover, the tempters and ensnarers have the last place, like the lowest place, one of which is present with every man, which we therefore call the evil genius, and their prince is Mammon, which is interpreted as covetousness. Plotinus in the 3rd century wrote about what he called the tutelary spirit. He wrote about it in the Aeneids. Plotinus described the tutelary spirit in much the same way as Plato, but with an interesting twist. Porphyry, writing on the life of Plotinus, recounts an incident in which an Egyptian priest convinced Plotinus that he could evoke a visible manifestation of Plotinus' own guardian spirit. And Plotinus took him up on it, and they go into a temple of Isis, where they do a ritual, and the priest invokes his angel, and a tremendous spirit comes through, greater in power and wisdom than anything the priest has ever encountered before. And he tells Plotinus that he's endowed with a mighty spirit, towering over those of others. And from this, Plotinus deduces that each person has allotted to him an angel of a rank according to their personal level of spiritual development in this life. Interesting idea. I don't know. A wise, spiritually mature person will have a powerful angel, whereas a foolish person will have a meek angel, a much less impressive angel, a newer angel.
Do you get an upgrade if you progress?
What? Oh, you mean in one life?
Yeah. Do you get a better angel if you progress in your life?
It'd be like an upgrade. Yeah. I don't know.
It's like leveling up.
Yeah,
it's like wings get bigger.
They get more eloquent.
Yeah, exactly.
Perhaps. I'm just presenting, I don't know, maybe. I would think that a certain amount of, you know, the idea of kind of spiritual destiny comes into it, you know, where, like, in your any given incarnation, you have a certain spiritual destiny that's going to unfold in a particular way. And the angel that's attributed to you and assigned to you, I guess, in that life determines that. Yeah, it's a very simplistic idea, but I don't know. That's what they thought. That's what Plotinus thought. And kind of interestingly tied into that, Apuleius refers to Socrates' demon as a god as well, inferring that his demon, Daimonion, was far superior to that of others. It's kind of interesting, and that Socrates didn't really seem to think of his own demon as being a separate entity that was assigned to him, as much as he kind of thought of it as a maturation of the soul. But his students didn't seem to think so at all. Students always disagree with their teachers. It's supposed to be that way. One of the terms that Crowley really latched onto when he was first kind of putting it all together in his head, what he thought the Holy Guardian Angel was the term Agoides. This is a Greek word meaning luminous body or shining image. In the context of the theurgy of the Neoplatonist, the soul's subtle body, purified by theurgic rites and daily prayer, itself becomes a vehicle for the descent of the divine, which in turn deifies the soul. So Iamblichus maintains that the shining vehicle is not an aspect of the self, or, let's see. Yeah, the shining vehicle is not so much an aspect of the self, but something bestowed upon the soul from the divine, and yet it grows out of the self. Let's see, there's the idea that you have to make a certain amount of progress in spiritual work before the soul becomes an appropriate vehicle for the divine, and that it attracts the rays of the divine, which come in and awaken something within the soul. So this is something that we'll visit again and again and again throughout the course of the lecture. This is an idea that shows up in a lot of other places. The soul first must be purified before the demon or the perfect nature or the angel will appear to it. In the Greek magical papyri, there appears a rite prescribed for a meeting with your own demon. This is found in Book 7, parts 508 through 528. In it is given a short invocation, first to Tyche, who's a tutelary deity who governed the fortune and prosperity of a city, along with that city's destiny. Then to the demons of the present place, hour and day. And then finally to Helios, who is invoked by several epithets and names. And this invocation is given with a short instruction. I'll just read that verbatim. It says, write the name in myrrh ink on two male eggs. You are to cleanse yourself thoroughly with one and lick off the name, break it, and throw it away. And what that name is becomes very clear when you read the actual invocation, which I didn't include here, but it's easy to find in the Greek magical power. I just look up PGM meeting with your own demon. It'll come right up on Google. Believe me, I've done this a lot in the past few weeks. So I'll start again. Write the name in myrrh ink on two male eggs. You are to cleanse yourself thoroughly with one, lick off the name, break it, and throw it away. Hold the other in your partially open right hand and show it to the sun at dawn, crowned with olive branches. Raise up your right hand, supporting the elbow with your left hand. Then speak the formula, which is the invocation, several times. Crack the egg open and swallow its contents. I was thinking we could all do that here. I got a bunch of eggs.
I'm curious how you know it's a male egg.
That's a pretty good question.
I hold it up to
like so many instructions in the PGM, it doesn't actually say.
Okay, just curious if I was missing something.
It goes on to say, do this for 7 days and recite the formula at sunset as well as at sunrise. Lots of egg eating going on at this time. So I'm not going to try to interpret this right, other than to mention that it's given an extended treatment in a book that really has recently been released by Scarlet Imprint, entitled The Holy Demon by Frater Archer. Anybody know who that guy is? I have no idea. Totally unfamiliar with the name. I keep thinking it's somebody else that's written other books elsewhere.
Crowley uses a lot of egg eating in his version of it.
And Liber Samech?
When Liber 8.
Oh, does he
the,
really?
The one
that,
yeah.
Really?
How
did
you could
that?
Only eat duck eggs and honey
oh,
eggs.
Okay, right,
and
right.
Isn't Agoades, isn't Ago Greek for egg?
Oh, is it really?
Yeah.
Oh, I had no idea. That's interesting.
That's right, the serpent
isn't
around
it?
The egg is
I thought actually. The etymology had to do with the dawn.
It was a little unclear. So some of the one of the versions of it has Ago as being egg.
I have heard that.
So one of Crowley's versions, or is that
somewhere?
Yeah, I'll show you Libra 8. It's on a 418.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I've got a big section on it here. A little section on it here. I forgot all about the duck eggs, actually. Of course, Coley would say that. He was eating oysters and one of his big... big operations. So moving on, the Gayat al-Hakim, or the Picatrix, contains a chapter on the Angel of Hermes, known in the book as the Perfect Nature or the Philosopher's Angel. The angel in the book is said to, it's associated with the star, or the core being of the individual, which of course Coley used that imagery a lot. He's not the only one. In it, Hermes, while seeking wisdom in a subterranean vault filled with darkness and winds, beheld a figure who appeared while he was sleeping. And that figure instructed him to take a lamp and to place it under a glass to shield it from the winds. Then to dig in the center of the underground chamber and there to find a certain God-made image designed according to the rules of the art. He was told that as soon as he brought this image up into the chamber, the winds would cease to blow. He was then told to dig in the four corners in order to bring out the light of the mysteries of creation, the causes of nature, and the origins and modalities of all things. And when Hermes asked the figure who was telling him this, who he was told, "I am your perfect nature. If you wish to see me, call me by that name." This, by the way, is chapter 3, or book 3, chapter 6 of the Picatrix. The philosopher's angel is described in the Picatrix as a tutor, guide, and initiator, said to be the object and secret of all philosophy, and the dominant figure in the sage's spiritual life. It is explicitly stated again and again that the perfect nature can only appear to one whose outer nature has been perfected. I think they're playing fast and loose with the word perfected, but there's something to that. Here's a quote from the Picatrix to give a flavor of Sabian philosophy, although it's not really Sabian philosophy. That's a whole other story. Anyway, give you a flavor, idea of the flavor of the Picatrix. The first thing you have to do in relation to yourself is to mediate or meditate attentively on the spiritual entity which rules you and which is associated with your star, namely your perfect nature, which the sage Hermes mentions in his book, saying, "When the microcosm which is man becomes perfect in nature, his soul is then the homologue of the sun stationed in heaven, whose rays shed light on all horizons. Similarly, perfect nature rises in the soul. Its rays strike and penetrate the faculties of the subtle organs of wisdom. They attract these faculties, causing them to rise in the soul, just as the rays of the sun attract the energies of the terrestrial world and cause them to rise in the atmosphere." So I want to kind of zoom in on a couple of these phrases. It says, "When the microcosm, which is man, becomes perfect in nature." Is there anybody that doesn't know what the microcosm and macrocosm are? I'll go over like a really super, super quick and basic definition. The macrocosm is everything that can possibly exist. The sum totality of the entire universe, including every thought, everything, ever. The macrocosm is individual reflection of that macrocosm. The microcosm is the individual, generally. It's said that in each individual is contained the entire universe in reflection. It's saying, by saying that the microcosm must become perfect, my take on that, and this is a very common school of thought in regards to this kind of thing, is that to make the microcosm perfect, you need to make it reflect the macrocosm. It already does in a way, but a lot of it's kind of broken and messed up and unrefined and hidden from us and unconscious. And so to perfect the microcosm, you have to bring out everything that's in it, everything that's you. Bring it all to the surface and refine it, develop it, equilibrate it, make it so it's all equilibrated. When nothing is left in the shadow, everything within the psyche has been brought into the light. Only then is the soul the homologue of the sun that is stationed in heaven. The metaphor kind of is that the soul then can reflect the sun, whereas before that it's kind of a bunch of random mirror shards and the reflection's all messed up. The sun, of course, is a symbol of wholeness. In Crowley's AA, and in general, I think, knowledge and conversation with the Holy Guardian Angel is generally attributed to the Sephirah Tephareth and to the great Adeptus Minor. That's at the halfway point of the Tree of Life, halfway between Malkuth and Kether. The enumeration of that grade is 5 equals 6. 5 is a pentagram, which stands for the microcosm. 6 is a hexagram, which is the macrocosm. 5 equals 6, basically what it means is the microcosm is equal to the macrocosm. It's a pure and complete reflection. All parts of the self at this point have been brought to the surface and are known. And the soul is a reflection of the sun, the spiritual sun. So So another little thing I want to kind of hone in on a little bit is its perfect nature rises in the soul. It strikes and penetrates the faculties of the subtle organs of wisdom. They attract these faculties, cause them to rise in the soul, just as the rays of the sun attract the energies of the terrestrial world. This is very similar to the idea of the Agoides. Something exists in the soul. It's latent. Something divine comes down when the soul has developed itself to a certain point and causes it to unfold. And one more quote from the Picatrix. The perfect nature is the heavenly entity, the philosopher's angel, conjoined with his star, which rules him and opens the doors to wisdom, teaches him what is difficult, reveals to him what is right, in sleeping and in waking. And I think this last part is extra profound. It's often said that the sleep of the adept is not the sleep of the non-adept. When the adept is asleep, they're communing with the divine or with the angel. I think there's definitely something to this. There's also, I mean, sleep isn't always necessarily terrestrial sleep, too. There are trances that are likened to sleep, like mystical states of sleep. Crowley calls it the sleep of Shiloam, which comes from the sleep of Shalom, the Hebrew word for peace. It's a mystical trance in which you're at once, you know, the difference between sleep and ultimate awakening are totally transcended.
Liminal state.
Liminal state, right. Let's see. So there's an Arabic concept found in the writings of many Islamic mystics, the Sufi divine guide or person of light, who, when the soul has reached a certain level of development, descends from the heavens and basically meets the aspirant at the halfway point. It's kind of an idea of like attracts like, too. You develop yourself to a certain point and you become kind of a magnet for the divine. And something, an emissary of the divine, comes down and becomes your guide. And that guide then goes on to act as a means of the crossing over the threshold of the halfway point and takes you further and further and further and further until you become one with pure divinity. It's said that the such passage can only be granted by the divine guide. It's said this by people that write about it. I don't know if I necessarily agree with that, but you know, it's kind of like, you know, this is how you do it, and this is the only way you can do it. Typical. Let's see. Moving on to Zoroastrianism. Zoroastrians had the concept of the Fravashi, which is a personal guardian spirit or angel from which each created thing is sent forth into the world, not only people, but also plants, animals, and minerals. The corporeal body is temporal. The Fravashi is eternal. One of the core tenets of Zoroastrianism is that all of manifestation is involved in this massive war between good and evil, between Ahura Mazda and Ahriman, for the fate of all creation. And that the faithful take place in this war, hopefully for the side of the good. The Fravashi specifically helps the soul of the individual in their fight against evil, helping the created being fulfill their purpose in the world, which of course always has to do with defeating Ahriman. That's just the way it works. The Fravashi is seen as the fixed point that stands above the mutability of earthly existence and is thus its guiding principle. It's like the nail around which everything revolves. The Fravashi exists before the birth of the individual soul they are assigned to, and the soul is said to return to it after death. It's the eternal principle of which the individual in any given incarnation is merely an expression. I feel like I just need to have like a water drip IV, but I wouldn't need to do this every once in a while. I
just need a camelback.
So Zoroastrian ritual practice was fairly simple. Generally, there's a sacred fire which is always kept burning, both in the temple and in every devotee's house. The fire is ideally fed with sandalwood. Incense is sprinkled on the flames. There are offerings of milk and bread. And prayers are recited over it while the devotee holds the barsam, which is a bundle of sacred sticks, which is the main ritual implement. I got an example of a prayer to one of the Fravashi. It says, invoke, O Zarathustra, my Fravashi, who is Ahura Mazda, the greatest, the best, the fairest of all beings, the most solid, the most intelligent, the best formed, the highest in holiness, and whose soul is the holy word. Invoke Zarathustra, this creation of mine, which is Ahura Mazda. Zarathustra imitated my words for me and said, I invoke the holy creation of Ahura Mazda. I think an entire theological treatise could be based on this prayer alone. There's so much interesting stuff in this. I looked at other examples of the same prayer, other translations, and they seem to be fairly similar. Because when I first read it, I was like, wow, this is out there. And I wonder if it's just a bad translation and it's not really as out there as it sounds. But it appears to be. There's a couple of things that I would point out. One of them is that the Fravashi is associated with the Horamasta, the highest god. There definitely seems to be the kind of thing where the speaker is speaking kind of alternately as Zarathustra, as a Horamasta. There's that whole thing where it says, now I lost it in this tiny little quote. Here it is. Zarathustra imitated my words for me and said, I invoke the holy creation of Ahura Mazda. There's just a lot of switching around and interesting contradictions. But in these contradictions, when you start really looking into them, there's a lot of theological gold. One of the interesting things about the Fravashi was that it's common in ancient Persia to invoke not only one's own Fravashi, but also the Fravashi of the more illustrious among one's ancestors. So to sum up, there's so much more historical stuff that I could go into, but I would need like a million hours to do it. And I'd need to know a lot more about history, so it would be hard. I tended to focus on things that I already knew a little bit more about. But just to give a sum of some of the ideas, Hesiod and Plato asserted that the holy demon is a tutelary spirit, either from a race that existed in the Golden Age or from the sphere between that of the planets and the Earth. Plato asserted that when the soul reaches the peak of its development, it becomes pure mind, is given a body of fire, and can itself become a guardian spirit in the service of the divine. There's the concept of the evil demon, the mirror image of the good, or agatha demon. Plotinus asserted that each person is assigned a demon from a particular rank according to their level of spiritual development in this life. Iamblichus and the other theurgists made reference to the agoides, which is the soul purified by theurgic rites and prayer. Theurgic rites are really not that different from Golden Dawn-derived rites. The Golden Dawn got a lot of its methodology from things that were ultimately derived from theurgy and from paganism before that. Theurgy is basically just Greek paganism with a good name. Pretty much it's... Iamblichus was basically a pagan, and he's like, I'm going to clean this up and make these people seem respectable. Anyway, doing theurgic rites and engaging in prayer... the soul becomes a shining vehicle and attracts a descent of the divine, which then deifies it. This is kind of, it's often been said that if there's a goal to the Golden Dawn work, it's apotheosis, which is the deification of the soul. In Zoroastrianism, you have the concept of the Fravashi, from whom the devotee... here it is. The concept of the Fravashi, from whom the devotee comes and who aids a devotee in achieving their true purpose, which is taking their place in the war against good and evil. And there's also the idea that one can invoke the Fravashis of their ancestors. The Piketich refers to the perfect nature or the philosopher's angel, the spiritual guide or initiator, which can be known only when the microcosm has been perfected and which is associated with the star or core of the individual's being. Islamic mystics refer to the man of light, whom descends from the heavens and meets the aspirant at the halfway point of their spiritual development, acting as an initiator to the greater mysteries. And finally, Abramelin asserts the Holy Guardian Angel is a representative of Adonai. So now I'm going to move on to Crowley's kind of... Crowley basically came and blew all this stuff up, basically. And I'll go over point by point how he did it and why he did it and what he wrote as a result of it. And talk a little bit about some of my own ideas pertaining to all that stuff. One of the things that I kind of get from seeing so many different approximations of what the holy demon is, you can have a lot of spiritual experience with a particular phenomena and still really not have the slightest clue what it actually is. It's kind of like you can drive your car really well and still not know how it works. One of the things that's been kind of becoming more consistent in mostly in internet conversations lately, and I think this is a good thing, is the phrase the term unverified personal gnosis. And when it's used correctly, when it's used incorrectly, it's used to shut people down that disagree with you. When it's used correctly, what it basically means is that while your personal gnosis, your spiritual experience is very important. That's the whole point of spiritual practice. But it's not objective experience. You can't say, you know, I had an experience of the Holy Guardian Angel and thereby I know how it works. Your experience doesn't tell you what it is. It tells you what your experience is. And that's, for you, probably the most important thing ever. It's not something that you can use to say, like, this is how it works. And it kind of explains, you know, these different people have different experiences over the centuries and aeons and whatnot, and decades, and all these different ideas kind of come out of it. I think each of these ideas has a certain amount of relevance. So the reason why I want to go over at such length Crowley's conceptions of the HGA and knowledge and conversation is that more than anybody else, it's through Crowley that we got our conception of the Holy Guardian Angel. It's because of Crowley that we probably even really know about it. Not a lot of people really paid that much attention to Mather's translation of the Book of Robert Mellon. He translated other books that just sunk like a stone. Nobody to this day really cares about. Somebody might have latched onto it if Crowley hadn't, but the fact is it was him that did it. I think Alan Bennett, at some point, who was basically Crowley's mentor in the Golden Dawn, lent him his copy of Mather's translation of the book. And Crowley just became obsessed, just latched onto it. So it's really through Crowley's ideas of the Holy Guardian Angel, and he really took it to some totally different places, that we get our ideas. He's just absolutely central to the modern current conception of what this phenomena is. So we really kind of deserve a fair amount of coverage. It's very much a cornerstone of his own magical order, the AA. And I think to really understand kind of how the occult world kind of looks at the Holy Guardian Angel today, it's essential to have a clear account of how Crowley himself came to understand it and deal with it. Let's see. So Crowley's first attempt at the Abra Mellon operation was aborted. He first attempted to do it right after he received his Adeptus Minor initiation in the Golden Dawn in January of 1900. He was first refused initiation, basically, in the London Temple, and he had to go to Paris, where Mathers initiated him himself. At that point, the Golden Dawn schism had already begun, partly because of Crowley. Mathers liked him. He sided with Crowley. A lot of people didn't like Crowley at all. And in fact, a lot of people didn't like Mathers because Mathers liked Crowley. It's all very gossipy. So Crowley got his 5-6 Adeptus Minor initiation from Mathers. He attained a house, Boleskine House in Scotland, and began his operation in the Easter of 1900. He got the house specifically to do the operation in. This later became the Thalamic Kaaba. This is the house of which he actually calls it that.
I know.
I think it's funny. He does. He even says it in the Book of the Law.
I should laugh in the OTO over that one. Sorry.
It's kind of funny, you know, but I admit it. you know, because that's where he received the Book of the Law. Now, keeping in mind, Crowley never had any version of this book other than Mather's translation of the French version. I don't really have a lot of faith in Mather's translations. A lot of other people don't either. So we have this butchered hack job of a version, and then we have Mather's translation, and that's what Crowley had.
His butchered translation of a butchered...
Exactly, yeah. That's so often how it works. Mm. But that's what Crowley was going for. I don't really know. Well, I guess I did talk a little bit about how he hit upon the phrase knowledge and conversation. He did definitely fixate on that phrase. So Crowley's summation from this time, he summed up in the Temple of Solomon the King, Book 2, The Magician. It's found in the Equinox. He says, Abra Mellon leads us by meditation and concentration through prayer to a one-pointedness, a vision of conversation with the Master, in all caps, so full of goodness and beauty, so full of rapture and ecstasy that no human tongue can express the same. Crowley's methods, according to his journals, of invoking this deity were a little bit different than just contemplation and prayer. His records of him basically laying in bed, reciting the Enochian keys, invoking the Angels of the Watchtower tablets in the way that he was instructed to do in the Golden Dawn, and just having these grandiose visions. And one of them, he's taken back to the beginning of all time and shown the inception of history. It's kind of get the impression he was just kind of messing around with the Enochian stuff, which he hadn't really had a chance to mess with too much before. Anyway, his operation was aborted quite early. He received an urgent telegram from Mathers, who was concerned that the London Adepts were revolting. Kind of were. Crowley came at once to his aid, convinced that in so doing, he was crusading against the ascendancy of the great princes of the evil of the world. The story unfolds. The story that comes out of this is completely insane. I wish I had more time to go over it in more detail. I'll just kind of give a summation. He basically showed up at the Golden Dawn headquarters in London, dressed in a kilt and wearing a giant mask of Osiris and wielding a huge ritual knife. And he showed up to seize the vault from the errant adepts.
That will totally go viral today.
It kind of did then, actually. Yeah, no, it didn't go well.
It's a huge number.
He did not seize the vault. So he didn't go back. You know, that was he basically his life spun out of, into drama and turmoil, and he had to save the order. Within the next year, he learned to hate Mathers and think that he'd become a vampire because his wife, who was a vampire, corrupted him. Anyway, a little while later, in the August of 1901, Crowley traveled to Ceylon. He was kind of still on vaguely good terms with Mathers at this point. And what he was doing was traveling all over the world with the idea that Mathers had sent him out as an emissary to, just like Abramelin, to collect the wisdom of the world and find the true wisdom. And that's what he was doing while he was climbing mountains and other stuff, acting like a general jackass all over the place. Read his confessions. It's
true.
He's not a nice man. Anyway, he made up with his old friend and mentor from the Golden Dawn, Alan Bennett, in Ceylon. Ceylon is now Sri Lanka. Who had totally forsaken the methods of the Golden Dawn and taken up Buddhism. Bennett instructed him in the methods he'd been using. And within 6 weeks, the 6 weeks of intense effort in meditation under Bennett's mentorship, Crowley attained to the trance of Dhyana. He describes his attainment by stating that Dhyana is it's when the subjective and the objective collapse into one. And he goes on to say, the phenomena usually comes as a tremendous shock. It is indescribable even by the masters of the language. All of the poetic faculties and all of the emotional faculties are thrown into a sort of ecstasy by an occurrence which overthrows the mind and makes the rest of life seem absolutely worthless in comparison. I mean, geez, if Crowley the poet can't describe it, nobody could. Anyway, he further goes on to say, the conditions of thought, time, and space are abolished. And the most important factor in Dhyana is the annihilation of the ego. Our conception of the universe must be completely overturned if we were to accept this as valid. I kind of feel like this says more about Crowley. But yeah. Anyway, I'm going to stop slamming on Crowley. It's way too fun. He's easy. Anyway, this experience threw Crowley into a massive period of turmoil and confusion. In those days, Crowley wanted to intellectualize everything. He was a massive intellectual. And he just absolutely couldn't rationalize or intellectualize his experience of Dhyana. Further, it didn't fit with any of the teachings of the Golden Dawn or anything that he'd experienced before that point. He more or less gave up ceremonial magic. He went back to London after a couple other things happened. And after a few false starts, he basically gave up his Buddhist meditations as well. He has the most awesome defense of this. He said that he had no problem meditating when there's a crowded cocktail party around him. He could quiet his mind, and that was not a problem. But he couldn't stand the cold, damn it. London was too cold, and of course, they didn't have central heating then. You had to build a fire, and that was distracting. And I think it's just his whole spiritual makeup was breaking down, and he was going into kind of a big dark night. Although he had a lot of fun on that dark night. He got married in the years to follow to Rose Kelly, received the Book of the Law, and did a whole bunch of other stuff. Read filthy poetry to his assembled guests at Boleskine. Whole bunch of stuff. So the action picks up again in December 1905. This is all documented in the Temple of Solomon the King, Book 2, The Babe. Crowley was in Burma, and he'd met up again with Bennett. And their meeting had somewhat of a profound effect on him. It kind of stirred up all of his old doubts that the Dhyana had thrown him into, all of his old confusion. And he began insanely trying to synthesize everything that he had known and everything that he'd experienced and trying again to intellectualize his experience. He referred to that period as a period of black insanity. He said that his intellectual faculty started just completely breaking down. He continued traveling through Burma with his wife. In February of 1906, he was thrown from his pony over a 40-foot cliff. The fact that he survived, he'd also survived a bunch of other mishaps shortly before that. He survived with basically little more than a scratch. This left him convinced that he was fated to be a spiritual leader. He decided that he was the chosen priest and apostle of infinite space. That's his words. After a little meditation, he concluded that he was sent into the manifested world to teach the knowledge and conversation of the Holy Guardian Angel. At first, he considered he had to actually attain to the magic of the Holy Guardian Angel. So right then and there, he decided to commence with the Abramelin operation. His method was to perform the Bornless Rite on the astral. astral plane while traveling through China, sometimes on foot, sometimes on horseback, sometimes sitting down. His wife and his newborn baby were traveling with him. So I'll speak really briefly about the Borgless Rite. That's the rite I have on the handout there. Although I totally changed it. It's a Greco-Egyptian rite that makes use of several barbarous names, including a bunch of Semitic names of God. It was originally called the Rite of the Headless One. The reason it came to be called the Bornless Rite was because somebody thought that headless meant beginningless, like startless, and so that must mean bornless and eternal. But as it turns out, if you look at the etymology of the whole thing, it really does mean the headless god, the god without a head. It's an unidentified deity known as the Headless One. There's all sorts of speculation as to who this god may have originally been. Jake Stratton Kent puts together a very interesting and compelling argument that it may have been Typhon originally. He has a lot of interesting things to say about Typhon. You find him in Geosophia. I recommend you check it out. But that's not known for sure. It's all speculation. The one thing that is known for sure is the Headless One is basically like the god of magicians, the god of gods, the highest god. Very, very powerful and very mighty. The rite is best known for a refrain that's repeated several times in the course of the rite that says, "Hear me and make all spirits subject unto me." This is the Bornless One talking. "So that every spirit of the firmament and of the aether, upon the earth and under the earth, on dry land and in the water, of whirling air and of rushing fire, and every spell and scourge of God may be obedient unto me." I have said this hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times in ritual, and every time I try to repeat it in a lecture, I mess it up unless I'm looking at the text. I cannot repeat it unless I'm in a ritual context. It drives me crazy. It's very anticlimactic when that happens. So anyway, Crowley does this ritual every day on the astral, sometimes twice a day. Right around the time he started doing that, he got this just insanely bad sore and swollen throat, sore throat with swollen glands. Got so bad that he actually took a vow of silence, a mini vow of silence at one point. Not so much probably out of any kind of asceticism, but just because it really, really hurt to talk. So he does this for a few months, and then in May he sets sail for London, still performing the operation every day. Or England, not so much London right away. On June 2nd, he's been doing this for a few months now, he learns of the death of his infant daughter, which of course completely devastates him. Rose Kelly, his wife, is more or less drowning in alcohol by this point. As it turns out, she's very much an alcoholic. But Crowley continues the operation on a daily basis. In early July, he goes to the doctor and is informed that he probably has throat cancer. The doctor orders immediate exploratory surgery, and Crowley is taken to a nursing home and has a really humiliating experience. But he continues the operation every day from his little nursing home bed. On July 9th, Crowley goes under the knife with a local anesthetic, and being Crowley, he performs the operation on the operating table. It's actually really funny. This is all in Temple of Solomon the King, and it's really, really very amusing to read. The whole, like, all of Temple of Solomon the King is good, but kind of for different reasons. This section is one of the best. Turns out he really just had a really bad throat infection. Doesn't have cancer of the throat. He's totally fine. In September, he's still doing the operation every day. He's been going at it for about 8 months. He meets up again with George Cecil Jones, who is a friend of his from the Golden Dawn, with whom he begins to discuss the possibility of creating a new magical order, which is the successor of the Golden Dawn. They basically say the Golden Dawn failed to initiate, and they decide that if they apply themselves steadfastly and seriously to the effort of creating this order, then the secret chiefs cannot fail to contact them. Meanwhile, Crowley is still not attained in knowledge and conversation of the Holy Guardian Angels, so his efforts continue on a daily basis. This is the beginning of the AA. It all kind of starts here. On October 2nd, they decide to put a new version of the neophyte initiation ritual to the test. Crowley takes on the role of the candidate. He smokes a little bit of hashish beforehand, as you do. And after 8 long months of continual effort, he finally attains to the exaltation that he's been seeking for so long. He attains, by his own account, to Atmar Darshana, which he relates in 777 to unity with Brahma and attributes it to the Sephiroth Kether, the highest of all of the Sephiroth. It's said that in Atmar Darshana, the universe is experienced as a continuous whole and the self is annihilated. In the course of the trance, this matures to Shiva Darshana, which he attributes to the Ein Sof Aur, And he says that in Shiva Darshana, even the unity that the adept experience in Atmar Darshana is annihilated by the opening of the eye of Shiva. The effect of the trance stays with him for several days, leaving him in a state of bliss. Meanwhile, several terrible things continue to unfold in the course of his life. He's finally confronted with the undeniable evidence that his wife is an alcoholic, and she's committed to a sanatorium. I think it was a little bit after that. Yeah, she was with him for a little while longer. Shortly after that, she's committed to a sanatorium. But through all this stuff, Crowley really can't be anything other than ecstatic, because he's in this holy trance. He's just enraptured in ecstasy. George Cecil Jones, who apparently was infected by Crowley's enthusiasm, proclaimed him to be a master of the temple, and even went so far as to claim that Crowley was the Logos and the next Buddha. Let's see. Over the course of the next several months, Crowley finds that he can repeat this experience, but only if he smokes hashish. Drives him crazy. He totally, he confirms. It's like, yeah, this is absurd. I'm going to be the laughingstock of holy men everywhere. The drunken yogi. And he totally is convinced that he's still the prince and priest, apostle of infinite space, but only when he's high on hashish. So, over the next year, he's smoking hashish on a regular basis and doing his meditations and attaining to high trance. Throughout this time, he writes several of his holy books, including Liber 7, Lepus Lazuli, and Liber LXV, the Book of the Heart Girt with the Serpent, which we'll touch upon later. All of these were delivered in a sort of trance, not delivered by him. These are Class A documents, which are basically channeled from a higher source. In the case of LVX, they came through the hand of VVVVV, which is Crowley's exalted consciousness, as a master of the temple. Finally, in the end of September 1908, while his wife is drying out in a sanatorium, he performs what became known as the John Say John operation in Paris, a two-week intensive working involving some ritual and lots and lots and lots and lots of meditation, plenty of oysters, and he's able to attain to the same exalted state of consciousness he'd attained to without the hashish. So finally, success. And for anybody that hasn't read John St. John, you can find it in the back of the first issue of the Equinox. It was the supplement to the first issue. It's also online. It's all over the place. It is hilarious. I highly recommend it. At one point, he invokes coffee, the spirit of coffee. He's falling asleep during his meditation. He does all sorts of unruly stuff. Mm-hmm. Lots and lots of lemonade. But he has to call it by its romantic name, because lemonade is not nearly romantic. Sugar water just wouldn't do it. Sugar water with lemon, sense, no. It's also very informative. There's a lot of really interesting stuff that comes out of John St. John. So we could take like a little break now. I could keep going. We could take a break, 10 or 15 minutes. Take a break? Okay. Yeah, I'll take a little break. My vocal cords can probably use a little break. And then a little bit, I'm just past the halfway point. Maybe a little bit just past the halfway point. So
sure.
Finish it up.
Are people warm enough? Do I need to turn the heat up? Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay.
One of the reasons that the Golden Dawn in London had a problem with Crowley was because he was bisexual.
Totally.
And was not, not devoted to hiding it as well as probably other members of the Golden Dawn who are bisexual. Then,
where did you read that? Where did you hear that?
I mean, it was one of the controversies around him. They were really uptight about sex anyway because of the Thomas Lake Harris stuff.
Yeah.
And so that was sort of like their catch-all for anything that was deviant. And they're like, oh, he's into like guys and Thomas Lake Harris and things like that.
They all went to British boarding schools.
Interesting point, actually. Yeah.
Not to say that he wasn't like a 23-year-old asshat too. He was obviously.
Sure.
part of it was unfair. Part of it was unfair.
Probably more about talking,
but you're right. Probably more about talking about it and
being open about it, and they couldn't deal with that.
There's some over there. Actually, we have a Berta. Yeah, go for it.
Wait for Kevin to get back.
So I looked it up. The eggs are in the other ritual from Liber 14. They're in the 38th or something.
Oh, okay.
Because that one you actually have to shut yourself in a room for like 2 days, 2 or 3 days.
Oh, yeah.
Subsist only on eggs, whereas the other one lasts like 91 days. And
right.
This whole thing.
Which came from them.
Which one is it?
Enochian one.
The Vision of Voice. Which one? The 18th, for the 38th are working, and the 8th for the gold, the HGA working.
Right. I knew I remembered the eggs.
I want to make a brief digression and let's see, what part am I on here? Oh, yeah, right. Kind of just talk a little bit about some of my own ideas. So one of the things that's strongly suggested in Crowley's work is that he had the conception of knowledge and conversation of the Holy Guardian Angel versus kind of the idea of the angel just showing up as kind of more of an astral vision. So judging from the descriptions given in the book of Abramelin, the attainment of the angel is more or less akin to an astral vision with benefits. Those benefits are things like rapture and ecstasy and communion. Crowley, on the other hand, was clearly going for something far more profound than this, with this eight-month-long operation that took him across China. Doing his initial attempt at the Abramelin operation, his focus was entirely astral and visionary, and that's very consistent with the level that he was working with at the time. But his experience with Diana, with Alan Bennett, kind of dramatically raised the stakes for him and urged him to seek out something higher. He wanted nothing less than a full-blown mystical experience involving ecstatic union with the angel. In light of this, I kind of postulate the following, and this is kind of a difference of convenience, but I would postulate that there's what's known as the vision of the Holy Guardian Angel, and then there's knowledge and conversation, and those can be considered two separate things. In no way is this really official. This is just kind of a convenience, but I think it's an advantageous convenience. So in column 45 of 777, attributed to the magical powers, Crowley lists the spiritual experience of Malkuth as the vision of the Holy Guardian Angel, or Adonai. Now, generally, Crowley attributed knowledge and conversation to the grade of Adeptus Minor within, which is in Tephareth, far beyond the grade of Neophyte in Malkuth. So why do we find this vision in the Neophyte grade? If you look at kind of the task of the Neophyte grade in Malkuth, in the Golden Dawn it would be called Zalotar, but Crowley in the AA calls it Neophyte. It's a 1 equals 10 grade that corresponds with Malkuth. The basic tasks of that grade are, first of all, the mastery of ceremonial magic. Almost everything in the Golden Dawn is in that one grade in the AA. And then, corresponding to the path of Tao that leads to the next Sephira, is the mastery of the astral plane. It makes sense that when you get to this level of development, you can attain to something that would fall short of knowledge and conversation, but could be, a full-on vision of the Holy Guardian Angel. In my own case, that's the way it worked. Contact with and a vision of the Holy Guardian Angel came quite a bit before anything that I would dare call, knowledge and conversation. Knowledge and conversation is something that I consider to be much deeper. The vision is a Yetzeratic phenomenon. Yetzirah is the Kabbalistic world that corresponds with the astral plane. Visions, dreams, words and images. So a Yetzeratic experience of the angel is one in which the angel appears to you and speaks to you and gives you advice. Hopefully, not just once, but you get a regular connection. Gives you a name, whereas the briotic phenomena of encountering the Holy Guardian Angel would be something much, much deeper. The next world above Yetzirah is the world of Bria. What really differentiates Bria from Yetzirah is in Yetzirah, everything is ruled by duality and opposites, kind of like it is here. You can't have light and dark at the same place at the same time. In the outer world, you're either going to be asleep or awake. You really can't be doing both at the same time. You could be half asleep and half awake, but that's not quite the same thing. In the world of Bria, opposites, instead of turning away from each other and contradicting, they turn toward each other and embrace. So you can have light and darkness being experienced at the exact same time as a single unified experience. Deep dreamless deep sleep and total awakening can be experienced at once. And this is a level at which a much, much deeper level of union can take place. You could say that the Yetzeratic kind of covers the magical and the Briotic covers the mystical. And in the mystical, of course, the boundary between self and other gets kind of, if not totally demolished, at least it doesn't work the same way as it worked before that. So true union is possible, where you lose your sense of self in the experience of this other. Let's see. So moving on to Lieber 8. About a year after the John St. John working, in late 1909, Crowley undertook a working in Algeria with Victor Neuberg, in which he scried all 30 of the Enochian Aethers successively. All sorts of stuff came out of this. Most of Crowley's mythology, that whatever didn't come out of the Book of the Law and the earlier holy books, came out of this Enochian working. It's all summed up in The Vision and the Voice. I read that. It was one of the first Crowley books I read, and it confused the living daylights out of me. You really have to have a background, not only in all sorts of Kabbalistic and Golden Dawn stuff, but really in Crowley mythology before that book makes any sense. And even then, lots of it's really confusing. It's all mystical vision stuff.
Takes a few reads.
Mm-hmm. But there's a lot in it. It was during this working that Crowley claimed to have finally crossed the abyss into the realm of the Supernals and finalized his title of Master of the Temple, which he first claimed a few years before that. In one of the 30 Aethers, the 8th, called Zid, he received a vision of a condensed operation intended to bestow upon the aspirant the attainment of knowledge and conversation. The main content of this vision was later turned into a Class D document of the AA, Liber 8, which was given to students of the AA who had attained to the grade of Adeptus Minor without and were ready to take the next step. The way that the 5 equals 6 Adeptus Minor grade works in the AA is it's divided into two parts. You have Adeptus Minor without and Adeptus Minor within. Adeptus Minor without is basically the aspirant aspiring to their holy guardian angel and doing everything they can to attain to knowledge and conversation. Adeptus Minor within is the attained adept who hasn't quite made it to the next grade yet. The rite lasts 91 days in all. Very specific instructions are given as to the preparation of the temple, the altar, the vestments, the fumigations, and the oils used in the operation. The aspirant is instructed to spend 11 weeks performing regular prayers, not less than an hour in length, to their angel, and to inflame themselves in prayer. The prayers are to be performed 3 times daily, at sunset, midnight, and sunrise. It's interesting. You get the impression that he was working around, he knew people would have a day job. Because he goes on to say that, if possible, and it may not be, that it's also good to perform the prayers an additional 4 times between sunrise and sunset. But he knew that, you know, well, if you work a day job, you can at least do it at sunset, midnight, and sunrise. During the last week of the 11 weeks, the aspirant must pray the full 7 times daily, so this is where you take your vacation. And during this time, they are to compose an invocation according to their own understanding, to write in letters of gold atop the altar, and also to copy it onto a sheet of virgin parchment. On the 12th day of, or the first day of the 12th week, they are to burn their vellum with the prayer written on it in the fire of the lamp, which hangs from the ceiling. Afterward, during the performance of the prayer, the chamber shall be filled with a light insufferable for splendor, I'm quoting, and a perfume intolerable for sweetness. And his holy guardian angel shall appear unto him. Yea, his holy guardian angel shall appear unto him, so that he shall be wrapped away in the mysteries of holiness. And the document continues. All that day he shall remain in the enjoyment of the knowledge and conversation of the holy guardian angel. And for 3 days he shall remain from sunrise to sunset in the temple. And he shall obey the counsel of his angel, or that his angel shall have given him. And he shall suffer those things that are appointed. And for 10 days thereafter he shall withdraw himself, as shall have been taught to him from the fullness of that communion. For he must harmonize the world that is within with the world that is without. Related to the microcosm and the macrocosm. At the end of the 91 days, he shall return to the world, and there shall he perform the work to which the angel shall have appointed him. So, of course, the rite is condensed. It's not 18 months, it's not 6 months, but 91 days. There's no explicit mention of the final part of the operation mentioned in the Book of Abramelin, in which the conjuration and binding of the unredeemed spirits is performed. The aspirant is supposed to spend 3 days obeying the counsel that his angel had given him, and then 10 days harmonizing the world that is within with the world that is without. I think I've heard some people say, well, this is where you invoke the demons or swear them to fealty. But I don't know. I kind of feel like if you look at the way the Book of Abramelin is structured, it's part of the mythology of the Holy Guardian Angel that we have now, that, well, you invoke your Holy Guardian Angel, and then you got to deal with the demons. And some people say, well, they have to be the demons that are in the Book of Abramelin, and other people say, well, they can be other demons, or some people interpret it as like you have to deal with your personal demons, which I think is kind of a weak analogy. The Book of Abramelin is really a book that's meant to turn somebody into a magician with the power of their angel behind them. So the whole thing where you're swearing the demons, you know, to fealty to the command of your angel, so that you could do all sorts of magic with them. I mean, that's your method of magic if you're following the practice of that book. So it kind of stands to follow that that part isn't really, you know, if you have a whole other magical system that you followed, like the curriculum of the AA, and then you go for knowledge and conversation, you're not really bound to the whole demon binding thing. That's more the part of the book that's a manual of magic. On the other hand, if you achieve to any radical shift of consciousness, something like knowledge and conversation would definitely qualify for this. Then basically what you're doing is you're taking depth charges and dropping them into your unconscious. And there's going to be some fallout from that. And I think some people interpret that as, well, then I had to deal with the demons because, you know, I did this operation and all this crap came out. And it was intense, you know, and the demons. I don't know. I kind of think it's kind of lazy thinking to associate spirits or demons with aspects of the unconscious. Not that the two things can never have any correlation, but I just don't think that they're the same thing. I know more than one person that has done extensive work with the Goetia, and it's still a psychological mess. So clearly they haven't totally fixed all their psychological problems. All of that stuff comes from Crowley. Crowley wrote in his introduction to the Goetia that he totally renounced magic at that point. This was after he had his experience of Dhyana and was kind of going through his scientific phase, trying to rationalize Buddhism through science. He wrote that the demons of the Goetia are the elements of the unconscious. Later, he totally went back on that and said, no, that's not what it is at all. But that stuck, and people still kind of clasp onto that to this day. Another document was given to the Adeptus Minor. That document was Liber Samech, which is subtitled Being the Ritual Employed by the Beast 666 for the Attainment of the Knowledge and Conversation of His Holy Guardian Angel. This is hard to say in one breath. During the semester of his performance of the operation of the sacred magic of Abrimelin the Mage, prepared N17 Sun and Virgo at the Abbey of Thelema and Cephaladium. Fancy word for kafalu. By the B666 in service to Frater Progradier. Frater Progradier was an Australian man named Frank Bennett, who had come to the Abbey of Thelema in 1921 after having chartered an OTO lodge in Sydney, Australia, and having advanced a little ways in the OTO, or in the AA. Crowley was, he had absolutely no patience for students at all. If a student showed the slightest bit of promise, he always wanted to whip them up for the grades, you know, and get them into knowledge and conversation, make them a master of the temple. He was really trying to prove the method of the AA at that point, and he wanted a bunch of people under him that had attained to these high degrees because that would prove the system. That would meant that it worked. And he was a little too zealous in that, I think. But there were some successes as well and some really interesting stuff that came out of it. When Bennett came to Cathalar, to the Abbey of Thelema, Crowley was fairly impressed by the progress he'd made in the AA, and he said, okay, it's time for you to go for knowledge and conversation. He whipped him up into the 5 equals 6 grade and said, by the way, you should go back and finish all that other grade work later. But for now, you know, 5 equals 6, we're doing this, man. And he wrote Liber Samech specifically for him, you know, taking the rite that he attained by the Bornless Rite and turning it into this big elaboration. Liber Samech is definitely a pretty sizable elaboration on the Bornless Rite. Let's see. Crowley makes a lot of really interesting statements pertaining to the phenomena of knowledge and conversation and the nature of the Holy Guardian Angel in Liber Samech. One thing he says is the main purpose of the ritual is to establish the relation of the unconscious self or subconscious self with the angel in such a way that the adept is aware that his angel is the unity which expresses the sum of the elements of that self, that his normal consciousness contains alien enemies introduced by the accidents of the environment or accidents of the environment, and that his knowledge and conversation of his Holy Guardian Angel destroys all doubts and delusions, confers all blessings, teaches all truth, and contains all delights. At the end of the document, the following instruction is given. Let the adept perform this ritual right, perfect in every part thereof, once daily for one moon, twice daily at dawn and dusk, for two moons next thrice, or Like twice daily at dawn and dusk for 2 moons, next thrice noon added for 3 noons, and afterwards midnight making up his course for 4 moons, 4 times of the day. Then let the 11th moon be consecrated wholly to this work. Let him be incessant and continual ardor, dismissing all but his sheer needs to eat and sleep. For know that the true formula whose virtue sufficed the beast in this attainment was this: invoke often, and have some hashish if it doesn't work at the end.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Frodo Pergradier, Frank Bennett, did this. He Crowley gave him a little tent, and he did it in his tent, with Crowley lording it over him the whole time. And apparently, according to Bennett's records and according to Crowley, he had success. And went back to Australia and ended up, God, I'm not remembering exactly, but I think Frank Bennett got really into Martinism afterwards, if I remember right. It's something totally unexpected. It's like, what? Anyway, that's what his holy guardian angel apparently told him to do. Point 3 of Liber Semic features a particularly salient comment on the nature of knowledge and conversation. Crowley says, but the phenomena of the knowledge and conversation of the holy guardian angel are a side issue. The essence of the union is intimacy. Their intimacy, or rather identity, is independent of all partial forms of expression. At its best, it is therefore as inarticulate as love. So again, we have, this speaks to a very briotic level of union, a very mystical level of union, attained by intense devotion. The Philosophus of the AA is given Liber Astarte, which contains instructions for uniting oneself to a deity through a prolonged period of devotion. It specifically stated that you are not to do that with the Holy Guardian Angel before you have success in Liber Astarte. And you get the impression that this is like the training. You know, you train yourself with a deity, and then once you're ready to go for knowledge and conversation, you have that under your belt. You can drum up that level of passionate devotion. Of course, the way that Crowley defines the attainment in Liber Semic sounds very different than the Atmar Darshana and the Shiva Darshana that he experienced earlier. You see his conception of knowledge and conversation kind of changed over the years. I think he kind of came to accept that his attainment was very high, and it was not something that he expected of the student at the 5=6 level of development. Nevertheless, the expectation of the 5=6 level was still fairly exalted, still very much briotic in nature. So the next and last Crowley document I want to talk about is Liber LXV, or Liber Cordis Cincti Serpente Subfigura ADNI, or Adonai. This is a Class A document. Class A documents are defined as documents that are not to be changed in so much as a style of a letter. Holy books, basically, that were brought through by Crowley and high trance from a higher place. This is one of the documents that he brought through while he was smoking hashish and attaining before his John St. John rite. So the book consists of 5 chapters, each one of which corresponds to an element. There's the 4 elements and then the 5th for spirit. The 4 elements represent the adult's relation with their angel in the light of one of the Kabbalistic parts of the soul, the one that is associated with the element that corresponds to the chapter. So the 1st chapter corresponds to earth and the nephesh and is based on the animal soul and sensation. The 2nd chapter to air and the ruach, which deals largely with the mind and the intellect, the self-image and the image-making capacity in general, as well as parables and narratives. The 3rd chapter is attributed to water and the neshama, or the spiritual perception. And the 4th chapter is attributed to fire and the chia, the primal spark from which every other aspect of self arises. This chapter is largely written, or at least partly written, from the point of view of the angel relating to the adept, as opposed to the adept relating to the angel. And then the 5th chapter for spirit corresponds to the yachida, and is, in a sense, the most straightforward of all of them. The book comprises an excellent study on the subject of knowledge and conversation as Crowley saw it. It can almost be taken as an encyclopedia on the phenomena. It's written for the soul as much as it is for the mind, much in the way that a piece of poetry is written in a way that's not supposed to be apprehended purely intellectually. The idea is that if you read it, and even if you don't intellectually understand it, something in you will respond to it, something beyond the intellect. Crowley's commentary on the book is very valuable as well. This has been published in a book called Commentaries on the Holy Books. I'm pretty sure Liber LXV is totally available on the internet, and I think his commentaries are as well. One important point, in the Book of Abrimelin, the angel is said to be a representative of Adonai, while in Liber LXV, the angel is identified with Adonai. This is something that Crowley does again and again and again. Identifies the angel with the highest divinity, with God. It's a key point of importance in Crowley's conception of the nature of the angel. So just to give one example from the text, from chapter 2, dealing with the Er and Ruach, is given a parable of the loss of the self in rapture, and the rapture of union with the angel, or the loss of the sense of self in that rapture. It says, I saw a pale, sad boy that lay upon the marble in the sunlight and wept. By his side was the forgotten lute. Ah, but he wept. Then came an eagle from the abyss of glory and overshadowed him. So black was the shadow that he was no more visible. But I heard the lute lively discoursing through the blue still air. Ah, messenger of the beloved one, let thy shadow be over me. So the angel swoops in, and the sense of self is completely eradicated in the ecstasy of communion. There's a section in chapter 4, the fire chapter, where he touches upon the idea of the dweller on the threshold, the shadow aspect of the angel, or the evil genius appears and is this just horrific-looking, bestial phantom. And the adept is, of course, terrified, but then he says, but I was anointed with the right sweet oil of the magister. I slipped from the embrace as a stone from the sling of a boy in the woodlands. I was smooth and hard as ivory, and the horror gat no hold. I would take the right sweet oil of the magister to simply be the higher intuition, the adept. With the idea that if you do get a manifestation of the dweller on the threshold, or the evil genius, you know, there's a part of you that absolutely knows what it is. It's fairly obvious. The evil genius, the dweller on the threshold, in my experience and those of others, there's really nothing to be afraid of at all, although it's often used as a boogeyman in some texts.
Depends on how much oil you have.
That's right. Right? Sweet oil of the magister. They sell it at Tenzing Momo. You have to ask for it, though. Yeah, go do that. You should. It's really good stuff. It's cheap. Yeah, it's free. Just ask for it. Yeah.
Some people are able to let it go a little.
That's right. Makes you a little bit smoother.
A boulder to sleep.
Well, Crowley uses the right sweet oil of the magister with Victor Neuberg, in fact. And I'll do it. It's all in the vision and the voice. It's all there in black and white. Not quite in black and white. It's kind of, everybody knows. Anyway. So before I step away from Crowley and go on to other matters, I want to very quickly revisit the question of the relation of the HGA to the self. There's a question, is the HGA part of the self, or is it something completely outside of the self? Well, of course, when you're dealing with briotic trance, that question is put into a completely different light. And there's also kind of the idea of, you know, is the core of the being, is the star or the cobs really oneself? 99% of the time when I say myself, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the personality and the conditioned self. Let's see. Crowley asserts in numerous places in his commentary to LXV and in Liber Samech and in several other places that the angel can be identified with Rahur Kuit, the voice of the third chapter of the Book of the Law. If you take the voices of the first two chapters, who are the parents of Rahur Kuit, you have Nuit, who is the absolute, undifferentiated, everything that can ever possibly exist, even in potentia. And then you have Hadit. Of course, Nuit can't be identified with the self in anything but the absolutely most abstract way. And you have Hadith, which is the core of the self, so intrinsic to the self that you can't even know it. I like to say that trying to know Hadith is kind of like trying to learn about your body by gazing upon your own unreflected skull. There's just no way you can ever do that. But it's absolutely you. And Rahur Kuit is the child of them both. So Rahur Kuit, as the Holy Guardian Angel, predicts a little bit of the individual and a little bit of the absolute, or equally of both. Actually, I shouldn't say the individual, a little bit. Rahur Kuit predicts absolutely of both in a way that transcends the duality that keeps those things separate. So, I don't know, I guess my take on it is that the individual and the absolute are transcended, or the individual and the absolute are transcended by the angel. The difference between them is transcended. There's a little section from Liber LXV that kind of speaks to this. In chapter 3, it says, also the coils of are of infinite range. He's talking about the coils of the snake that is girding about the heart. The heart that thou dost encircle is a universal heart. meaning that in the throes of trance, which Crowley is here likening to the heart being squeezed to death by a serpent that's winding around it, and that serpent is the angel, there is no difference between the individual self and the universal. The difference between those is broken down. It's the marriage of self and everything, self and divinity. In another place, in Liber Summit, Crowley says that the magician asserts that he himself is the angel or the messenger of the angel. That is, that he is a mind and body whose office is to receive and transmit the word of his angel. Jim Eshelman is fond of stating that the true will is the word of the holy guardian angel, the word being, of course, the creative expression. Okay, we've made it to the last part of the lecture. I don't think anybody's asleep. We're all still alive. I still have a voice, which I seriously wasn't sure was going to be the case. The last part, I want to talk about my own advice as to how one might approach the task of first making contact with the Holy Guardian Angel and then deepening that contact into something that may be called knowledge and conversation. Knowledge and conversation is an interesting thing because we really don't have a really specific definition. You know, we have Crowley achieving Atma Darshana and Shiva Darshana, which is like, geez, really? It's a little high to shoot for. I can't even imagine. And then we have, you know, Crowley's changing conception of it throughout the rest of his life. So it's like a moving target. So it's really hard to say, like, how do you know that you've attained knowledge and conversation? And I would say a convenient description is just, well, if you attain to an astral vision and that becomes a regular thing and that grows deeper and deeper and becomes stronger, well, the next thing after that, in terms of depth and intimacy, that's knowledge and conversation. That's the best I got. Works for me. I don't know. But so the first step of getting contact, assuming that you're a ceremonial magician in the Golden Dawn tradition, I would only assume that because that's what Crowley was, and that's the only thing I really know, so I can't really give any other way of doing it. The first step is to integrate and master the full range of forces associated with the tradition. So the elements, the planets, and the zodiacal signs. That covers everything. Between them are covered all 22 Hebrew letters, which are the basis of the creation of the world. By integrated master, what I mean is invoke. Know them inside and out, both in theory and experience. Make them a part of you. Live in them and through them. Let them become a part of the furniture of your world. Know them so well that they're like your name, your mirror image. You know them that well. The goal of this is 5 = 6. In other words, the microcosm is made to be a mirror of the macrocosm. By working with these parts of the self, you bring out parts of the psyche that are not developed, that are not refined, and then you further refine parts of the psyche that are naturally refined. If all of your planets are in Leo, I pity you. But, you know, the first thing you'd want to do, yeah, then you get up in front of people and talk for 3 hours. Wait a minute. The first thing you would want to do would be invoke Aquarius, because that's the opposite of Leo, to bring out what's not developed. But then you also have to do a lot of work with Leo as well to bring that to a greater state of development and refinement. Anyway, every aspect of the self must be brought into the light, developed, refined, and made to serve your aspirations. There's a psychological dimension to the work as well. Whatever makes you uncomfortable, explore it. Identify with what repulses you and love it. To a point. You know. There are things that repulse me that if I were to get too into, I'd be dead, you know, so I don't, you know, cyanide repulses me. I'm not going to, you know, it's common sense. But I think this is one of the meanings of love is a law, love under will. You identify what it is that arbitrarily repulses you, and you go towards it, and you integrate it. You make it a part of you. Doesn't mean you have to vote Republican or Democrat if you are a Republican. But, you know, you try to integrate the point of view as much as possible. It's especially important with things you have a very emotional repugnance to. The point is not to be a slave to your reactionary impulses, but to make conscious decisions as to what you identify with based on your spiritual development. Until you do that, you can't really follow the advice of your angel, because your angel will tell you to do something, and you'll be like, no, I didn't do that. That's, go to a sports event? Screw you. You know, you won't be fulfilling your true will if you don't go to that sports event. You can imagine all of reality as a circle with yourself in the center. Some parts attract you, other parts repulse you, and thereby you become unbalanced. So part of the work is to strive to actualize the entire circle and identify with each part. In the Golden Dawn, in the Outer Order, before attaining to the grade of Adeptus Minor, it was first necessary that the aspirant work with all four elements separately. There's a grade for each element. And then to integrate those elements under spirit in the portal grade that led to the grade of Lesser Adept. In the Golden Dawn-based order that I was trained in, every student spent a minimum of 6 months working with each of these grades, invoking and banishing the element on a daily basis, doing elemental meditations, integrating the elements into the middle pillar, thinking about the element nonstop. The goal was to absolutely immerse oneself in that element, to live and breathe it, to eat and sleep it, to let it drown you and then be resurrected within it. And then in the portal, you invoke all four of the elements under spirit at the same time for 9 months minimum. I don't regret a single minute of this work. It pays off tremendously. I think it really does stuff that are absolutely worth doing. Now, you can invoke the elements, so I found through experience, for a long time, as long as you banish them every day as you invoke them. Don't just invoke them and not banish. You get really wonky if you do that. You can invoke and, you know, banish the elements every day. It doesn't really throw you much off balance. It seems like it would, but it kind of doesn't. It's definitely a good idea to work with all four of them. I find when doing that with the planets, it does make you a little wonky. The times that I've tried to do that, if you invoke Luna every day for like a month, it physically hurts after a while. Me and another person found that. So you can work with the planets kind of cycling between them. You know, work with Luna and then work with Mercury and then Venus and then, you know, work with all of them and then go back after Saturn to Luna. The same can be done with the zodiacal signs. Cycle through them. Work with them one at a time. Integrate them all. Meanwhile, master the arts of invocation, evocation, and the consecration of talismans. Each of these skills will give you something that will be useful to you in the pursuance of the vision of and knowledge and conversation with the Holy Guardian Angel. Invocation allows you to see through the eyes of gods and to exalt your consciousness in various directions. How am I doing on time? I'm just about done with this, but I want to make sure I'm not... Okay, yeah. Okay, we can do it. In about 10 minutes? Oh, wait, this goes to 9:30, doesn't it? Okay, well, I won't slide.
It can go until whenever you want it.
Okay.
Exactly.
Keep going. I want to make sure I don't make my audience fall asleep.
No, you're rocking. Go.
So, by learning to invoke the gods, when you really do a potent invocation, you are seeing through the eyes of the god. At least that's a subjective experience you have. You invoke Isis, you have the experience of being Isis. You lose yourself in that experience. You look out on the world as Isis, and you can even speak as Isis. This opens doors. It just does something to you when you learn to do this. One of the things that can happen in the Bornless Rite when you attain proficiency in invocation is that you learn to see through the eyes of the Bornless One, which is kind of like a generic version of a god. It's the god of gods. It can be seen as like the highest god. This is invaluable in my mind in approaching the angel. Evocation and spirit work allow you to communicate with spirits, which is very, very useful if you want to talk to your angel. Otherwise, you won't be able to do it. Manifestation work allows you to make changes in your life, which you'll need to do in order to act on the advice of the Holy Guardian Angel. Consecrating talismans, too, it's an art in and of itself, and it's one of those things, but by mastering that art, you learn a tremendous range of things that are useful to you in every aspect of magic. Basically what you want to do is master the corpus of ceremonial magic. Everything in it will give you something that'll be useful to you. As you gain proficiency with these skills, you'll also be learning to focus your mind to a fairly high degree at will. Once the basics of ceremonial magic have been mastered, or perhaps a little before they've been mastered, you can turn your attention to astral work, especially the opening of the astral senses. Do things like scry into the tarot cards and the tatwas over and over and over and over again until the techniques have been mastered, until you get a really crisp and clear vision and you can do it very easily every time. What you're doing is you're opening up your inner senses. Even before you do this, that starts to happen. You know, as you start even with the basics of magical practice. But this is the point at which you really, you know, finely tune and hone your astral senses, your inner vision. Of course, you need this in order to see your angel, to hear your angel speak. Instruction in all of these things can be found in the works of Crowley and about 100 different books on Golden Dawn magic that are currently glutting the market, as well as all over the internet. Let's see. Once you feel that you've mastered the techniques of ceremonial magic and have thoroughly integrated the forces of nature and have given yourself some time to play, and I think this is important, ceremonial magic is a giant, massive playground and you should have some time just going, wee! Don't deny yourself that. Then you can turn yourself to turn your efforts towards the attainment of the vision of the angel. The technique, as per Crowley, is to inflame yourself in prayer. I used the Bornless Rite myself, at the end of which I would, I created a bunch of different invocation litanies to the angel, and I would deliver them, or sometimes I would just do spontaneous invocations. I personally think it's important when you do stuff like that, you know, you put forth the effort and you put it out there, then you have to sit quietly and let it come back to you. So I have always made a practice of, after the invocation has reached its climax, you know, sitting down and just quietly waiting. That's when the good stuff happens. Scrying the Enochian Aethers helped me a lot. I didn't really do this until after I made initial contact, but once I started scrying them, I started having deeper and deeper experiences with the angel within the Aethers, and that kind of kicked off a whole round of going deeper and deeper and deeper. Once the angel has been contacted, ask for their name. And this can be used to contact your holy guardian angel thereafter. This is super important in my personal opinion. I think this corresponds to the inner depths of your soul. The name is something, it's like a lot of people have experienced this. Crowley definitely did as well. You can continue to unpack this name for several years and perhaps decades to come. There's just a tremendous amount of meaning in it. I always like to advise people, don't share the name with anybody else because there's no reason anybody else needs to know that. Folk legend kind of states that if somebody gets the name of your angel or the name of yourself on that profound of level, they can use it to do evil magic against you. And I think if you really have your magical chops, that's probably not really true. That sounds kind of like folklore, but there is the alchemical metaphor of the hermetically sealed vessel. I think there's a power to be had in keeping something secret. And the things you should probably keep secret are things that there's no reason anybody else should ever need to know. By putting something in a hermetically sealed vessel, you keep it pure from outside influences, and it swells in power in its purified, consecrated, sealed vessel. And so by keeping the name of your angel absolutely to yourself, I think it just gives you something extra. It keeps it more powerful. It keeps it from being trivialized. I think, yeah, there really is a power. I think there's even power in having initiatory secrets that you only tell initiates of your temple. It's just I don't think these should be anything that are really practical because, anyway, we're going off on my personal opinion here. Anyway, secrets can be good. No, this is getting way off topic. Once you've established the vision, invoke often. I would advise have as little expectation as possible. The angel can surprise you. There comes a point at which it comes time to deepen the union with your angel, to go to the next step. I think this requires generally a more intense effort over a period of time. It's kind of, you know, there's always the hardest parts in any spiritual path are the crossing of thresholds. The first crossing is crossing from Asiya to Yetzira, and that's where you open up your astral vision and get really visionary. Some people have a really easy time with this. Some people have a really hard time with it. I had a really hard time with it. I had to work my ass off to get that to work. Other people do it, you know, right off, and you're like, you lucky bastard. You know, but that can be a fairly hard threshold. The next threshold is between the Yetziratic and the Briotic, going from the magical to the mystical. I would be surprised if there's that many people who find this one easy. The dweller on the threshold is what sits right on the other side of that threshold, messes with you when you're trying to cross it, but not really in any truly dangerous way. So, you know, you get to a point where you reach the end of your Asiatic and Yetziratic work. You've mastered ceremonial magic. You've mastered the astral plane. You can do all sorts of stuff. You can open up any Golden Dawn book and do pretty much anything in it. You don't know where to go next. And, you know, that's one of the frustrating things about the Golden Dawn and about ceremonial magic in general is you get to a period, if you practice it enough, where you're like, okay, this is great, I can do this, and this continues to serve me, but what's the next step? And this is a step in which you know, it's ideal to push yourself over the threshold into the briotic, into the mystical, into union with the higher, into knowledge and conversation, if that's how you choose to deal with it. It's like, going from standing on the shore of a vast ocean and watching the waves roll up to walking in and letting it just completely drown you. Also, the angel will probably tell you when it's time to do this. Let's see. Crowley prescribed a number of meditation practices that help with this. His advice and mine is to exalt your consciousness to the point at which you're seeing through the eyes of the highest God, the Bornless One, or another, and from there to fervently aspire to union with your angel. Quieting your thoughts as best you can and simply waiting. You'll notice this is not that different from the method you use while you're trying to get contact with the angel. The difference is that I think this threshold is a little bigger and takes a little bit more of a concentrated effort. Something like a modified version of Liber 8, where you have a very intense and concentrated period of work. When you've gotten to this point is pretty likely to give you success. Let's see. Knowledge and conversation, I've got written down here, is attained not by your own will, but as an act of grace on the part of your angel. There's a lot of things in the path that are like that. Somebody in this room reminded me of this passage a little while back. From Liber LXV, chapter 2, it says, "To await thee is the beginning, not the beginning. And what I think that means is you do as much work as you possibly can. You strive and strive and strive and strive and strive. Do everything humanly possible. And then you simply wait and surrender and become receptive and open up. And that's when the angel overtakes you or not. You have no control at that point. It's not about you. It's about what the angel does at that point. That applies to all sorts of mystical paths and attainments. Finally, what do you do with knowledge and conversation after it's been achieved? Invoke often. Keep the flame going. Keep the door open. Achieve the union with regularity so that it may grow deeper. Okay, other than the Jung part, which I may or may not talk about, that's about it. Does anybody have any questions?
I have an interesting one. Crowley talks about IWAS, SSHGA, which you didn't bring up. That's one of the... How do you...
Well,
with everything you said, how do you fit that in?
Crowley, he often referred to IWAS as the holy guardian angel of humanity and the Aeon of Horus. Mm-hmm. There's a passage in the book of, I think it's Magic Without Prayers, or Tears. Magic Without Prayers. That's not how you invoke your holy guardian angel. Magic Without Tears, where he talks about how... he says something like, "The poet in me knew all along that IWAS wasn't the name of my holy guardian angel." And you get the impression that he didn't really... That's probably the case with him, but he didn't really know that. Keeping in mind that Crowley never really seemed to talk about the vision of the angel much. Crowley's first real attainment with the angel was like Atmar Darshana. And you can't be an Atmar Darshana and get a name. There's no names and images in Atmar Darshana. So I don't think he really engaged with the angel on that level. So it kind of makes sense that it's like, well... Maybe later in life, he's like, wait a minute, I think IWAS is my holy guardian angel. I mean, who knows if that was really the case or not, but he seemed to indicate that he thought this was the case later in life. There's a practice, is it Liber Reguli, where you do like, no, it's not. One of the ways in which Crowley did the Kabbalistic cross is to say IWAS as you touch your heart.
The Mark of the Beast?
I think it's the modified LBRP that they were doing in Chaplin.
Right.
Yeah.
And what I think he was getting at with that, I've never felt comfortable doing that.
Yeah, me too.
It just seems weird. What I think he was getting at with that is he thought that, well, IWAS is the holy guardian angel of humanity, and it's kind of like the surrogate angel. You know, he's your holy guardian angel until you get a connection with your own, and then you replace it with your own. That's my closest guess.
I'm sorry, go ahead. Well, I was going to say that Crowley also says... might be in Liber Samech, he says, no one knows the name or the rite by which to invoke the angel of another. And IWAS does not fit that description at all. Elaine Simpson invoked IWAS for Crowley and had a conversation with him. So
that's right.
That right there.
Yeah,
that's like,
interesting.
Nice.
So if you look at all the things Crowley says about the angel, and this has bearing on the issue of, you know, in what sense is the angel an objective being? If it's a sort of objective being like, you know, for example, like the angel Gabriel, for instance, right, where anybody can invoke them, right? Then that breaks that rule that he has.
Right.
So maybe that rule is... So either that rule is wrong, or Iwas was not his HDA.
Well,
or
there's historical precedents for it being wrong.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, so there's the Porphyria, the story of the priest invoking the angel, or the demon, of Socrates. And then there's the idea of the Fravashi, where you can invoke your ancestors' Fravashis. I think I read something about, like, it's not only your ancestors, you can invoke other people's too, but you generally do it with your ancestors.
I'd have a whole army with all the...
yes, there is. You know their names. Didn't get them all.
Earlier you were talking about the parts of theme, or the five parts of the...
All right.
So I was just wondering, like, how does the Shekinah fit in with your HGA... theory that you've been discussing?
God, that's a good question. I haven't really ever thought of it. The Shekinah is like the presence of God, the presence of divinity, that comes down from Bina to Malkuth. I mean, if anything, off the top of my head, I would guess that's it could like represent like the presence of your angel, but here I'm just making stuff up.
Like a nimbus or a like a Shakti almost.
Yeah. And the Shekinah is, you know, because it comes from something very specific, and then it was later recontextualized all over the Zohar and by later Kabbalists. I mean, you know, all these different things. And so it's kind of, I don't know how it would relate.
In so much as Shekinah is the bride of Adonai, like
yourself
would be the Shekinah.
Yeah, right.
No, that makes sense.
And
yeah.
The way Crowley describes it anyways is that you're essentially marrying Adonai,
yeah,
and you're waiting for it to come down to you. And
that's nicely done.
Well, that's what made me think about it, was when you were talking about the kind of like from the union aspect of union with your higher self.
Individuation.
A lot of the language gets similar there too. So there's a Jewish tradition where you comment on the Torah, which is said to sort of contain the Shekinah. But anyways, you comment on the Torah, and you're bedecking the bride for Adonai to come down and dwell within it.
Mm.
And Crowley uses similar language in like Liber 65, the LXV, where he says you're being bedecked by nature and perfection for the bridal of Adonai to come down and dwell with you.
Yeah, I had attended a Simchat Torah just recently with a Reconstructionist group where that essentially went on. They don't know that that's what they're doing. And this Torah was, and they're pretty sure it is the first Torah that was completely inscribed by women only.
Oh, interesting.
And if you're interested in it, just Google Kadima. And you can find it through there.
Is it with a Q or a K?
A K. Kadima. K-A-D-I-M-A. Their Torah, they did a project that took 4 years. I was a part of it, where the whole Torah is done by women. And it's really interesting because their Simchat Torah is about invoking the Shekinah into everyone who's present there. If you stand, because they roll out the whole Torah, it goes through the whole room, and anyone who steps inside of it, you have that experience.
Mm.
And I came here tonight because I'm interested in the divine union and all of its meanings and aspects. That's kind of what I'm studying right now. So, and the HGA has come up for me in that regard.
Oh, interesting.
And I had that experience when I was at that ceremony. So I was just interested in the OTOs. When I saw your thing on Facebook, I was like, I want to see what they have to say about this.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for coming.
So, yeah. I believe that that's kind of something that's sort of evolving as humans move into their discovery of the divine union. So, yeah,
I kind of get that from Crowley, too, that's the idea of... you know, he had a lot of really unfortunate ideas about anthropology and his kind of aeonics thing. But, you know, he was also going with some, as far as I know, some of the things that a lot of people thought at the time. But if there's any truth to the idea of the succession of aeons, that could be part of it. You know, that idea of that we're just, you know, what was once totally veiled is becoming more out into the light. Maybe. I have no idea.
So one of the things that's part of the tradition from Abramelin, which kind of makes its way into how Crowley deals with it in its own weird way, right, is the idea of purification of the self. And I think in Abramelin, it's a lot of it's sort of like ethical in nature, traditional ethical stuff. I haven't looked at it really closely myself. Do you have any commentary on that? I mean, you mentioned a lot of the ceremonial magic stuff and magical technique. Do you think there's any element of self-purification or ethical stuff that feeds into it?
Oh, absolutely. So purification, I mean, when you, for something to become pure, it just becomes more itself and gets out foreign or alien elements. I think that that there's been a huge shift kind of in spiritual consciousness generally, especially amongst us occulty types. Fairly recently, purification used to be seen as totally a moral thing. And now it's kind of seen more as a holistic thing, like becoming more whole. So to become purified, you become more whole, more yourself, you bring the elements. It's not so much becoming good. And Crowley speaks to this a lot, about how, you know, and like Jung says, I'd rather be whole than good. Crowley talks about how becoming holy isn't about being, you know, bringing out the best aspects of your character and focusing only on those. It's about bringing out everything and developing it. And I kind of see the idea of true will as being, you know, like, philosophically anyway, whether this is really the truth or the way things work or not, philosophically you have the idea that a human individual is kind of a machine that's designed for doing one particular thing. But the way we come into the world is kind of all wonky and we're all broken and we're subject to things like karma and accidents of conditioning and birth and everything. And part of the great work is to you know, purify each aspect of the machine, refine it and develop it, make it what it's really meant to be, so that when everything is up on the surface, when the microcosm reflects the macrocosm, when 5 equals 6, everything, like the gears all interlock, and the individual works as a complete machine. And then they can do their true will and completion. And I think, you know, you never get 100% perfect. You're always going to have some fucked up gear somewhere, you know, a little rusty on some part or something. But I think that's the idea. And I don't think it's a static thing either. It's a dynamic thing. You have to keep doing it. Keep yourself on point, even after you've achieved that initial purification. But yeah, that's something that it showed up in a lot of visions that I've had and a lot of other work I've done too. There are Golden Dawn rites that are based on purification. And I've long taken that and kind of experienced that. It's like you're burning off the parts of yourself that are purely arbitrary, so that the parts of yourself that are really essential can come out and flourish. And even the arbitrary parts are parts of yourself, but it's like they're twisted around and reflected backwards. And so purifying yourself is, you know, it gets everything in your microcosm in order.
One of the interesting things you were talking about in there, which I think relates to this, is sort of the issue of being able to trust and trust in the directive of your angel. Like, to me, that seems like the kind of tying into that aspect of releasing those other things, those other minor gods that you sort of cling to or you know, believe in, and kind of surrendering to that.
I think it's a developing relationship, too. You know, it's not like necessarily you get a first glimmer of your angel and then you're like, absolutely, you know, surrender to them, because you might be getting a bad astral vision, who knows. But over time, you learn to build that trust. The same thing happens with deities, and I don't think that having a strong relationship with your angel precludes working with deities at all. In fact, I would say that I don't think that the way that things work kind of beyond the veil is that you have, like, concrete entities necessarily. I think everything works in a little bit more of a way that the human intellect has a hard time grasping. But I think the idea that a deity could speak, or your voice could speak through the mouth of a deity, or your angel could speak through the mouth of a deity, through the voice of a deity, is totally valid. I can't really think of a time I've ever worked with a god and had them contradict something that my angel was telling me. Some spirits, sometimes it happens, but that's a whole other thing. But there's that continuing.
I would agree with that. It's your go-to.
And there's deities I absolutely trust. There's deities I've worked with for years, and it's like, I still have that really strong bond with. And it seems like it's a good mutual, it doesn't contradict any relation I have with the angel.
Yeah, when I said minor gods, I meant more figuratively, like those idols that you follow. I should have been clear.
That's okay. It still went interesting places.
Yeah. Cool. No, that makes sense. Thanks.
So, do you think the vision is like dating the actual knowledge of God.
Yeah, Jim, there's someone talking about it that way on his website.
Consummation. I mean, it just seems like...
Somebody asked, they're like, well, if knowledge of conversation is like, you know, the most intimate sexual encounter you can possibly have, what is the vision of the angel?
It's dating.
And he
right?
said a date.
Yeah, yeah. I came up with the exact same analogy.
Sure.
So I'm glad we have the same. Yeah. Hope you like each other, right?
Yeah, I think so. Okay, my voice is actually starting to flag.
Thank you. Thank you.
Anybody wants my Jung section and my Yates section? I can give me your email. I'll email it to you.
And I'm gonna do a whole thing on Jung and mine.
Oh, okay, awesome.
But I want that.
I don't even remember what's in it. I totally didn't even go.
No,
over
it's okay. But no, I'm just you're awesome. Yes, I would like everything you've got.
I'll send you
Thank you,
David. What?
Yeah, I'd like to
eat. Yeah, let's hear about
that. That's really short. I can do that.
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't remember what's in it, so we'll see. I remember it's not very long, though.
Yeah, I want to hear that.
We'll keep recording then.
Oh, it's like...
Everybody else.
Like, two paragraphs.
I have to run.
All right. I'll see you.
See you, Phil. Bye.
There's not a whole lot in it, really. In 1918, Yates published Per Amica Silentia Luna and put forth the idea that the angel was the opposite of the earthly self. And in order to invoke it, a mask should be made which expresses those qualities most remote from the outer personality. So I'll come back to me now. When the artist assumes the mask and becomes the other self, the angel is attracted because the person has become more whole and can be invoked. And the idea is you make a number of masks. You make masks for whatever it is you don't identify with.
That's really interesting, actually.
That really is.
Let's see if there's anything else I have. You know, that's pretty all I have on Yates. And then Jung, it's a bunch of quotes.
It lines up with Mima's mask. She, that was
a
big part
right.
of what she was doing. Oh, that's fascinating.
Very interesting.
Creating masks. It's fairly similar, though, to invoking just using a sigil or a name or, you know, invocation, but the idea that you'd actually...
I kind of get the impression it's the making of the mask. That's a lot of it... you're trying to identify this part of yourself you don't identify with, and you bring your creativity into it, and you bring your hands into it, you know, and you get your hands dirty and make a mask. It seems like
HGA workings are a lot of arts and crafts.
Yeah,
ceremonial magic is a lot.
Arts and crafts, holy garden.
It is.
Shopping.
Thank you. Awesome. Thank you.